Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Sunday, December 30th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening are Jillian Ross and Peter Thompson doing the first session of the Pieces the Way retreat. Today's session number is Peace 2001-01, and it is entitled Peace and War Texts in the Bible. Let's listen in.
And so we'll start with that and allow people to gather while we're learning that. We don't have a lot of time for tonight's session, so we want to get going as soon as possible. So Joe's going to teach us our theme song.
Right, which many people are. Mm-hmm.
Come on.
So welcome, everybody. And this is the one that I sang at dinner just now, and I'm sure a lot of you already know it. And actually, someone told me there's a third part, which I don't know the words to, but if anybody does, maybe we can incorporate that into it. So I'll just sing it once through, and the words are up there. If you don't know it, you can kind of turn around and look at it. So what we thought is just each morning when we got together, we could sing this song, and then throughout the retreat, just do some other singing as well. So I really have a strong belief and feeling about human voices singing together is a very, very powerful uniting force. So I'll sing it once through. And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. The second part. And into plowshares beat their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And into plowshares beat their swords, nations shall learn war no more. Let's do it all together. And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. And into plowshares beat their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And into plowshares beat their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. And into plowshares beat their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And into plowshares beat their swords, nations shall learn war no more. So as we go through the next few days, we'll sing that often. And then we'll work it up into the round, and then if anybody knows the third part, we can add that. So it'll be this kind of evolving theme song that we kind of grow with over the few days. So, welcome.
Thank you. On behalf of Peter and Joe, I'm Jill, and I'd like to welcome you to the Pieces Away retreat. The first thing we'd like to do, there's some people who arrived today that it's hard to see hands in the dining hall. If you could stand up, it'll be a quick little liturgical dance up and down and say your name so we all know each other's names to start. And why don't you start on the spot? That's why you sat there.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Catherine.
I'm Elizabeth.
I'm Julia.
James.
Yeah. Christy.
Ricky's already standing.
Go in the front row here.
JD.
Terry.
I'm Bernie.
Jack. Jeshua.
Ada.
Vicky.
Being chicken 90 or anything?
I can say whoever I am.
You could. You could be whoever you want tonight.
Dave.
Ken.
Anita.
I'm Tom.
Dan.
Scott.
Ben.
I'm Janet.
Mary Ellen.
Aaron.
Barbara. Mm-hmm.
And that's Janice.
And that's Janice. And Lola and Matt. And I am Jill Ross, recently on staff with the international staff of the ELCA in Mexico City for the last 7 years. To my right is Peter Thompson. Say a little bit about yourself.
I'm up here on long-term staff, and I've been driving to the Central Washington Hospital most of the time for the last 3 months. Before I got here and became a professional ambulance driver, I was a criminal defense and human rights lawyer in Minneapolis for the last 33 years.
And Joe?
Hi, my name's Joe, and I love seeing and teaching. Facilitate groups of, I work with teenagers a lot, and right now working at the Juvenile Detention Center with nonviolent, working with teenagers in that way.
So let's begin. This evening we're going to begin with a centering prayer that's going to be part of our worship, and it has been a part of our Peace Vigil prayer this week. So as you listen to these words, become centered to the retreat that peace is the way. Peace is an act of the heart, but what is the heart? We have a sense of this something within that calls us to feel, and having felt, to open ourselves, if only a little, to another living being. As if that soul were a part of our soul, as if his or her mind were our very own. It is a strange experience for us to have this tiny belief in the possibility of love, than to find ourselves acting in another person's interests. Sometimes the act will come first, and then the little particle of love will follow. Sometimes we must simply say, I will make at least one puny effort today to treat another as if we were one, even though I will expect nothing in return. What are the consequences of a past so contrary to the ways of the world? Possibly there is no external reward at all. However, one gift is assured. Should you choose to so proceed, a day will come when you will find yourself singing with angels here on earth. And that song will be, I am one with thee, O thou infinite one. I am where you are. I am where you are. I am because you are. Let us take a moment of silence to enter into this time of retreat. We thank you, O Holy One, for this time together. In the name of the living Christ we pray. Amen.
Amen.
As we began to prepare this week, we first pre-prepared and sent you texts and had texts available. And so we titled this session this evening as an introductory session, Is War the Way? We wanted to do that to take a look at some of the texts that are in the Bible and talk about them a little bit, that the challenges living out our faith in a time when people are going to be asking us questions, when some of us are going to be asking ourselves questions of how we believe in relation to what the Word of God says, and how we relate that to people in the outer community. So that's where we're going to start tonight. And does everyone have access or a copy of those texts? There are some up front here if you don't know, a lot of extra copies, so if you could share those.
And if you want a Bible to look
at... There's Bibles right up there.
Yeah, any more context, there's a whole bunch of Bibles right out to be by the front table.
Why don't you go ahead and do the
Yeah, sure. While you're getting those, I would maybe just start, you know, since the war was announced and began, we have had lots of conversations here in the community in the last few months and lots of struggle about all of these events. And there are different opinions from different people, lots of different opinions. And it's also when we have gone out of the village, which I alluded to I've been doing frequently the last few months, have been kind of shocked at what we found in terms of the opinions out there and how they may make us uncomfortable from time to time, particularly to speak how we may feel. And more than anything else, we think since this retreat was already scheduled pieces of the way, it looked very clear, at least to me, that most of the people, if the polls are right on the outside, have decided that that's not right. That right now, at least in these circumstances, war is the way. And so first, we talked about maybe just changing the name of the retreat altogether from Peace is the Way to War is the Way. But this session has sort of changed in that way. And so we have some text here that have come up both in discussions we've had around this. I remember when this first one under war text, Matthew 10:34, says, "Do not think I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword." I remember that being said within days about of our discussions about if a war was going to begin, here in the village, hearing it. And it's a little daunting for me to be talking about these texts because there are several people here who are theologians and several who are pastors, and I am neither. But every time one would come up, I would want to go look at it and try and find out what it said and what it didn't say. And what I really found in looking at all sorts of these different texts is that there's more than one message in the Bible. And there's more than one interpretation to things. And so as we talk about these tonight, I don't think this is going to be like a technical Bible study, looking at text. If it were, I'm sure I wouldn't be sitting up here in front of them. But it's an opportunity for each of you to say what you might think, what you are called to, what other things you think about, how you, you know, interpret the events that are going on right now, the dropping of bombs in Afghanistan, and whether language such as this is language which supports that kind of military reaction that our country has launched into quite quickly. This particular, and I kind of cheated besides, you know, just looking at the Bible, I also talked to some people who were pretty smart about this stuff and found some other sorts of verses. But this particular one, Matthew 10:34, actually was mentioned to me by someone in the village as support. But if you just continue to read right beyond that, after 34 comes 35 and others, where it says, "For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and one's foes will be members of one's household." All of which sounds quite violent, but what is it that he is talking about? "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Those who find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it." So what Christ is talking about, at least in this one passage, is not at all whether or not there should be military reprisals, or is saying that violence in terms of those things is good or bad. He's really talking about the test he brings to Christians. This was in the early times when being Christian even was illegal in many places, and that it could take great courage to be a Christian. It may take such great courage that it would cleave you from your family, that it would separate you from your loved ones, and that you would have the kind of courage to be a Christian that you would meet that sort of test. So at least this first version in my reading of these subsequent verses doesn't really even relate to what it was told me it meant when it was mentioned to me that Jesus said, "I've come with a sword." Anyone else want to share something about that?
Yeah. Well, I see Jesus as speaking to the oppressed people and not the oppressors. And in that case, I would look at that same situation through the magnifying glass the other direction and say, well, how about the terrorists that did do this action in New York City? Were sort of following their own sort of "I've come to bring the sword" kind of verse. That's the way I would see it. Because it's not, Jesus is not speaking to the oppressor, he's speaking to the oppressed.
Very good. Any reactions to that? Let's look at the next one.
Next one, I want to ask it in the form of a question to you. After we go over, it's Matthew 21:12. Then Jesus entered the temple and drove out all who were selling and buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. There, when I teach liberation theology, there's always a question that comes up about what happens when people who are oppressed turn to violence as a solution. So that's a question that I would pose to you. As you look at situations in the world, is violence ever an appropriate response? I studied this text in a Bible study with Guatemalans in Chichicastenango, where a group of people in the village were worshiping in church one Sunday morning when the soldiers came. And they locked the door of the church and set it on fire with the people inside. So the people who weren't worshiping that day, were out farming in the hills, hadn't made it to church, had to watch their loved ones be massacred. And that action turned them into what we read in the paper as guerrillas. And a guerrilla movement began in that village. And so that's always a really challenging question that comes up in response to, is violence ever an appropriate response? In the Mark version of the same story, there's Jesus makes a sound in Greek in the original language, and it's the only time it's used in the New Testament. And as he's turning over the tables, the sound he makes is like a horse snorting. He's so angry. It's that sound that's not even human. So my question from this text is to you, how do you wrestle with that? When is violence, or ever is violence, an appropriate response? And I think for that one, I don't know if we'll, do we have time to divide into small groups right now?
I don't think in this session, because we better close by six.
Hold on to that one then. We're trying to keep time for dialogue, or take dialogue from here as well as these questions come up, so that when you're in the dining room over these next 3 days, that you can talk about this more and have a dialogue about it, and we don't have to come to a conclusion about it, but just starting to ask the questions tonight then. And we'll have more time also tomorrow in the sessions to have more dialogue about it. Going on to number three.
Can I say something about that?
Please.
These are all very significant to me, and complex in the sense that just looking at a verse doesn't say enough, doesn't say near enough, especially in Matthew 21:12. My understanding of that situation was there was a lot of ripping off of the common people going on at that time, and the people running the temple, the people selling these doves and so forth, were committing social violence, social injustice. And to really understand Christ's wrath at that situation is to try to understand the injustice that's going on there and so forth, and not just his external expression. And I really have to wonder if a statement of anger in turning over tables that are hurting people, not the tables are hurting people, but the,
right.
the money exchange, the twisting of people's arms to give so that they can be one with God by buying these things and so forth. It seemed like an unjust situation.
It was another question as we discussed doing this, and as in your own life applied, are there current situations? What is the boundary then of when you would turn over the table is another question.
Well, I think what he's saying is the context of each one of these passages. And without the context in which these passages arose, then we lack the meaning. I mean, to me, just an isolated incident, regardless if it's contemporary, without an understanding of the context in which that incident grew out of, then we're at loss. We're lost. And I think it's one of the big issues that we're facing right now with this whole current situation is that Americans have very little understanding of the context in which this situation rose out of. And the media and the government, which is different than the country. I don't think our country has gone to war. I think this government has made the choice to go to war because that's their modus operandi. That's the kind of way their minds, if minds are there, they think. But I think that's the biggest issue is what is the context that these events rise out of? And if we can get more aware of the causes. I mean, the Dalai Lama, in his response to September 11th, said, it is time for us to turn to look at the roots of these events, not the symptoms. And that's what the war is attacking. It's attacking systems. And it's, to me, that's a cultural issue. It's just the same way we approach medicine. We cure cancer. We're going to attack cancer. When cancer comes out, grows out of a context, a series of choices that were made that produce a result. And that's the hard one for us to face as Americans, culturally, because we think of the American dream. And I think it's the American dream is the biggest problem, because we're not looking at reality. You know? We see we have to manufacture this illusion in order to feel connected to it, rather than seeing how wonderful it is in its own unique way. Right.
Scott?
Thank you.
Well, I agree with you. I like what you're saying. I was a little taken when you said the American people are not at war. When I believe it's our lifestyle that ends up bringing us to the place where we have to have a battle like this. And to say the government is doing it, I believe they're doing it in order to lift up the American lifestyle. So just by living the way we live with the high use lifestyle, we're causing this war, and I think we're very much part of it. And without our need for it, I don't think our government would jump in and do it. I think they're doing it to meet our needs, and therefore we're culpable as long as we continue to live high on the hog.
As part of the context.
Yes. And I think we're the money changers. We're living off shortchanging the rest of the world. And I think it's interesting that going on from this passage where, you know, Jesus obviously is so upset, he curses a fig tree who's done nothing except for not bear fruit. and yet it dies.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy?
I was just going to say there's a fairly significant school of thought out there right now that would agree with the passage as not a non-violent action, not a violent action, but destruction of property, for instance, is not a violent action. Whether or not you agree with it is another matter, but I think that you could use that text in that way. That text could actually defend destruction of property as a non-violent action, not a violent action.
I was thinking between what Jack said and that thought is that when four of us were down at School of the Americas in Georgia in November, and a lot of the people there had on their t-shirts or their signs, "Not in my name," as to whether or not this is the country or this is the government or what it is. And also, I read exactly that, Jeremy. One of the commentators about this particular event talked about it as a carefully thought out disruptive act by Jesus in doing something that was illegal. And it made me think of civil disobedience.
Ben? Yeah, I believe also that civil disobedience, but even if we were to call it an act of violence, there's a pretty big leap between turning over a table and dropping a 15,000-pound bomb on people. I know which one I'd choose somebody to come at me with.
In terms of that, what is violence? One thing that I found in a related text is that in Ephesians it says, "Be angry but do not sin," implying that anger in and of itself is not sin. Is violence, anytime there's fear, is violence only when there is physical harm? Is violence whenever you are angry? Is anger a legitimate human emotion that only becomes violent if it's acted out? I don't know.
I was thinking for myself, the animal sound that you were saying, it's interesting, I haven't heard of that before. The Greek word was suggesting an animal sound that he was making, because it seems like the animals are a pretty good example of natural responses, and we're animals, and I often think about the wolf pack, and that if the wolf pup is threatening the group, the older wolves will leave it or kill it. And it seems like there's times somebody said, nobody wants to fight, but somebody better know how. Thinking about the people being locked in the church and burned. An infinite amount of other things going on where somebody has to respond with what we would say is violent. So my impression is that, at least for myself, that I think that there's a place for violence, and that I would like in my own life to think that I would move towards non-hatred. But I don't think that I feel that non-violence completely is feasible, realistic.
Anyone else? James?
It seems to be heading in the direction of times when a violent act is actually preventing further violence, which is a weird thing to think about. There's a lot of quotes out there about that sort of thing.
You speak up?
Yeah. Talking about, it seems like with the wolf pack and with turning over the tables where a violent act further down the road prevents violence. Whether that's really possible or not is an interesting thought, especially currently. People who do terrorist attacks are desperate and extreme people in extreme situations, and they're trying to change their situation, and they're trying to stop it, the violence that's happening to them. And yet if they're coming at you and they say, we're just going to keep coming, it's somehow, you're saying, somebody, we don't want to fight, but maybe somebody has to be able to. But I'm not saying that's right, it's just, it seems like that's sort of, you know, Scott said we're the money changers, and in which case, you know, the terrorists, maybe we're turning over our tables, but it's also can be seen the other way too, and I'm not sure where we are really.
I think these texts relate a lot to the life of Jesus as well as the early Christian community. And to be nonviolent, I mean, we come out of a human evolution from thousands of years ago to where we are here in the 21st century. And certainly there's a lot of violence in that path, and some people say the Bible is the most violent document they can think of. I've heard some pretty critical people say that kind of thing. But look at the life of Jesus, as at least I understand it. He spent a lot of time in the desert or at prayer. And the early part of his ministry was spent in the desert, that 40-day fast, as the passages relate to it, struggling with the forces that were going on within him, the struggle for power. You know, do I go for worldly power, or is there a heavenly power? So my sense is Christ was struggling with these questions and forces in his own life, in his own time. And his message in Matthew, you know, all the messages are beginning with the Sermon on the Mount down to the when you fed them and when you clothed them and when you gave drink to them, you did it for me. I mean, I look at all that stuff and I have a hard time seeing Christ as a violent person. He was a very confrontative person, and here it seems that he let his rage and anger be expressed. But as far as I can tell, he didn't hurt anybody. And he was very concerned about people being hurt. So, you know, I agree with you when you say nonviolence seems unrealistic as a simple statement, but I've determined in my own life that nonviolence is the way I have to try to live. And for society to survive, for the human race to survive in the context of weapons of mass destruction and in the environment, that the destruction that's going on there, we have to go nonviolent. I mean, I'm saying a lot, but I feel we're struggling with a big picture here in Christ's time, let alone a big picture here in the 21st century. And wow.
For now, Kent's hand, and then we're going to, Kent had his hand up before, and we're going to stop because we don't, just for the sake of time at this point, and divide into smaller groups so that everyone can get a chance to speak to and continue this dialogue. So Kent.
Go ahead.
Or pass it so one more person can speak, and then we'll divide into.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that to me, you can pull something out of the Bible, a quote, to justify almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it more significant is when you have a context where the message is very clear, like, you know, the Matthew 5, or the Romans 12 on the peace text. I mean, that's crystal clear what's meant there. There's no ambiguity. What I wrestle with is that, and maybe this will get into with the Bob on violence, but it's a man who I greatly admire, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and wrestled with this, and he went a different route. And I guess that's what I, when you're confronted with what looks like true evil, then how do you respond to that? That's kind of what I'm struggling with right now in this context.
It seems to me there are really interesting issues there in terms of not only did he choose a very violent act and did it on moral grounds, but then you have the other issue. Think of all of the people. This came up with the judge last year with all of these religious protesters, and he said, you know, I know you're entirely sincere in your violating the law and doing something wrong, but can we allow each person to make that their own decision? Or is that chaos? So there seems to be enough now of these issues bubbling up that Jill just suggested it might be a good idea for us just to take a few minutes and break into groups of six or seven so everyone can talk. Otherwise, you know, we're not really gonna have an opportunity for everyone to talk about some of these things. About nonviolence, about civil disobedience, about what is violence.
And if you want to start with these texts that we sent you, we wanted a starting point to begin the dialogue with people coming in. I believe that we believe that we couldn't make an assumption of where people's starting point or common denominator might be to look at this. So these are for you to start with, to go from, to put them into context, and to talk amongst each other. And in a smaller group, if you find someone you don't know, give everyone a chance to speak. There are extroverts and introverts amongst us, and in a smaller group, sometimes the introverts get a chance to share their voice. And we'll do that for about the next 10 minutes, and then unfortunately we have to close up after that, but we'll come back into the larger group and start sharing. So spread the chairs out in groups of six or seven.
And maybe while we're doing this, Joel will sing a little song while you get up, or you might do it at the end?
Let's do it then.
Okay. But we only have about 10 minutes so they can get in here for Vespers. But what I'd suggest is that after we have these groups, find someone who can be here tomorrow morning, because this is a natural, we're going to talk about just war tomorrow morning. And it would be really nice if one person from each group could report back to everyone about some of the things and ideas that were brought up, so we can have some continuity and not lose this. Does that make sense? Okay, well, why don't you grab six or eight people right near you.
Someone you don't know.
Let's talk about this.
Spread out around the room. We'll have to put the chairs back, but we can discuss on the other side. Could you join us, please?
Joe, it's time to sing a song.
We're going to close with the song this evening. Before we do that, if you could get those chairs in approximation to where they were, because we're going to have worship there waiting to come in and light those candles for us.
Good. Okay, this is a very simple song, too. And I just wanted to say this to kind of, I'm sorry, just to get over, that. About four times I've been part of something called a Maori heart circle. And it's a community of people getting together, working out an issue, and after each person speaks, everyone sings a song. And that's how this could go on for 10 hours. Someone speaks, and it's like a testimony or something, and then the community sings a song. And the point of it basically is to really bring into the room always that balance between the head and the heart, so that you're constantly back and forth between an intuitive, feeling, spiritual place and a cognitive, intellectual place. So I feel like my place within this retreat is to keep bringing back that balance too, which I think is a very important thing for us to speak then from our hearts. So it's clear we have many, many, many views in the, you know, and ideas. And one thing, this is a simple song. It's basically, I think, is appropriate when there's not a lot to say that's definite. It just goes, I'm gonna keep on walking forward. Gonna keep on walking forward. Keep on walking forward, never turning back, never turning back. I'm gonna keep on walking forward.
keep on walking forward. Gonna keep on walking forward. Never turning back. Never turning back.
Gonna keep on loving deeply.
Gonna keep on loving deeply. Gonna keep on loving deeply. Keep on loving deeply.